Nemoto presents Addiction, Punish or Heal. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 22 minutes. The war on drugs described a set of policies that treated drug use primarily as a criminal problem to be contained by force. It drew authority from moral panic and from the belief that prohibition would suppress supply, deter demand, and produce public order. Over 5 decades, these policies expanded police powers, increased penalties, built prisons, and militarized borders. The result, measured against stated goals, was escalation without resolution. Drugs remained available, potency rose, prices often fell, markets adapted, and harm shifted from one neighborhood or country to another. What changed most decisively were the lives of those caught in the crossfire, people who used drugs, their families, and the communities where enforcement concentrated. The modern framework took shape in the United States during the early 1970s. A new federal scheduling system categorized substances by perceived medical value and abuse potential. A federal drug agency consolidated enforcement. Mandatory minimum sentences and state laws modeled on harsh prototypes locked in severity. By the 1980s, political messaging framed drugs as an existential threat. Television campaigns, school lectures, and high-profile arrests created a climate where fear was policy's strongest ally. Funding shifted toward interdiction and incarceration. Treatment and prevention occupied smaller budgets and frequently appeared only after crisis. This punitive architecture rested on 3 assumptions. The first assumed that supply could be choked by seizing drugs, destroying crops, and arresting sellers. The second assumed that demand could be deterred through surveillance and severe punishment for possession. The third assumed that criminal justice institutions were proper venues for addressing a medical and social condition. Each assumption proved fragile in practice. Supply chains adapted rapidly, moving production to new regions, switching transport routes, innovating concealment, and replacing seized product quickly. Demand proved resilient because demand was rooted in distress, habit, and dependency rather than in a simple calculation of risk. Courts and prisons carried heavy caseloads while lacking the tools to address withdrawal, trauma, or mental health disorders that co-occurred with substance use. A brief look at how markets responded clarifies the adaptation problem, sometimes called the balloon effect. When enforcement squeezed one point in the system, eradication campaigns against a crop, raids on a set of labs, interdiction along a known corridor, production and trafficking shifted elsewhere. Poppy fields cut down in one valley were replanted in a neighboring province. A smuggling route closed by patrols was replaced by another across a more dangerous border or by maritime paths. The total volume of supply did not contract reliably. Instead, risk premiums were absorbed as costs of doing business, and violence increased as organizations fought over the remaining profitable routes. Each tactical success produced a strategic displacement. The balloon did not pop, it bulged in a different place. Domestic enforcement followed a comparable pattern. Crackdowns in one neighborhood redirected sellers and buyers to adjacent blocks. Arrests removed individuals temporarily but often increased volatility as new actors tested boundaries and consolidated control. Sentencing policy created long terms for low-level distribution and possession while leadership adapted. In practical terms, the people least insulated by wealth and status experienced the majority of arrests, court dates, and incarceration. This concentration produced predictable collateral damage, disrupted families, reduced earnings, housing instability, and the normalization of supervision as a feature of everyday life. Punitive policy also reshaped policing. Asset forfeiture laws allowed agencies to seize property suspected of connection to drug crime, creating incentives that skewed priorities. Stop and frisk and similar tactics multiplied contacts between officers and residents, particularly in Black and Latino neighborhoods. The immediate outcomes included arrests for minor infractions, warrants for failures to appear, and criminal records that complicated employment and housing for years. The long-term outcome was mistrust. Cooperation between residents and police eroded, making violence harder to investigate and ordinary crime prevention more difficult. Communities shouldered both the harms of drug markets and the harms of aggressive enforcement. Penalties did not fall evenly. Drug laws that distinguished sharply between forms of the same substance produced dramatic disparities in sentencing. Mandatory minimums removed judicial discretion and transferred power to prosecutors. Three strikes provisions and truth in sentencing rules lengthened terms beyond proportionality. These design choices expanded prison populations and diverted public money into expansion and maintenance of carceral systems. The shift was not a brief emergency response. It became a structural commitment that crowded out alternative investments in treatment, housing, education, and employment programs that could have addressed underlying conditions. Schools absorbed the war's rhetoric through curricula and assemblies that emphasized abstinence and fear. The messaging rarely acknowledged why adolescents experimented, how to reduce risk if experimentation occurred, or what steps to take when a peer was in danger. Programs built on slogans underperformed because slogans neither met adolescent curiosity with credible information nor provided practical steps for safety. The distance between message and adolescent experience undermined trust and discouraged disclosure. When disclosure is dangerous or humiliating, help is delayed until the crisis stage. Prisons and jails became de facto detox centers without the staffing, protocols, and medications required to provide evidence-based care. Abrupt withdrawal without medical support endangered health. Release without continuity of care increased overdose risk, particularly when tolerance had declined during incarceration. In some jurisdictions, medication for opioid use disorder remained unavailable within facilities for years despite clear evidence that access reduces death and recidivism. Where medications were provided, recidivism declined and post-release outcomes improved. Where medications were withheld, the cycle of relapse and return repeated with grim predictability. The war on drugs did not remain within national borders. International aid and training exported interdiction and eradication strategies. Some governments militarized enforcement, pitting state forces against criminal networks that funded operations through drug profits. Civilians were caught between rival powers. Violence surged in regions along transit routes and in production zones. Journalists documented cycles where high-profile arrests were followed by power vacuums and internecine conflict. The resulting instability pushed migrants north, where the same drug war that contributed to displacement met them with criminalization. The human cost traveled the same routes as the contraband. Public health data told a separate story from political speeches. Over decades, the purity of many illicit drugs increased while price indices adjusted for inflation often declined. Overdose patterns rose and fell with changes in supply but remained a persistent threat. Injection-related infections proliferated where sterile supplies were scarce and where fear of arrest kept people from accessing services. HIV and hepatitis C spread faster in cities that refused syringe exchange and slower in cities that adopted it. When naloxone distribution widened, fatalities dropped sharply in programs with strong coverage. These outcomes were not mysteries. They were consistent with basic principles of risk reduction. Where policymakers treated drug dependence as a health condition, mortality and morbidity declined. Where policymakers treated it primarily as a moral failing to be punished, death and disease rose. Another cost came in foregone research and distorted priorities. Strict scheduling of certain substances limited clinical investigation into potential therapeutic uses and into safer treatment models. Universities hesitated to propose studies. Funders edged away from controversial topics. The public conversation flattened into a binary, tough or permissive, moral or decadent, for or against. In that flattened space, careful evidence lost ground to spectacle. Campaigns prioritized visibility over efficacy, and symbolic victories replaced measurable improvements. A serious appraisal of the war's results is not a claim that all enforcement is futile or that drug markets should be ignored. Violent trafficking organizations require a law enforcement response. Fraud, corruption, and coercion within medical and pharmaceutical supply chains require a regulatory response. The failure lay in substituting these targeted functions with a generalized war on people who use drugs, and in mistaking courtroom victories for public health progress. The blunt instrument cracked the frame that held communities together without touching the forces that drove substance use. Alternative models demonstrated that different outcomes are possible. Jurisdictions that decriminalized possession for personal use while investing heavily in treatment saw declines in deaths, disease transmission, and incarceration. Programs that integrated medication for opioid use disorder into primary care reduced relapse and improved employment. Heroin-assisted treatment under medical supervision stabilized individuals for whom other treatments failed, reducing criminal activity and improving health. Supervised consumption sites decreased fatal overdoses in surrounding areas, connected participants to services, and reduced public disorder. None of these interventions required romanticizing drugs or ignoring harm. They required distinguishing between the harms of drugs and the harms of policy, then designing responses that minimized both. Drug courts attempted a hybrid. Participants were offered dismissal or reduced charges in exchange for treatment and supervision. Outcomes varied widely depending on the court's design. When eligibility excluded those with the highest needs, programs served healthier defendants rather than those at greatest risk. When sanctions for relapse were severe, courts reproduced the same cycle of punishment under a therapeutic label. The strongest versions offered medications, used graduated sanctions sparingly, rewarded incremental progress, and coordinated closely with community providers. The weakest versions chased compliance metrics and expelled participants for the very symptoms that define their condition. Public spending patterns illustrate choices. Large enforcement budgets built capacity to seize and imprison. Smaller health budgets funded treatment programs that turned away patients during surges. Waiting lists discouraged help seeking until harm grew acute. The mismatch signaled priorities to the public. There would always be resources to arrest, but not always resources to heal. Over time, this message shaped expectations. Residents who believed help was unavailable stopped asking for it. Providers burned out under caseloads that combined clinical labor with constant fundraising. Legislators grew accustomed to appropriations that bought visible action rather than long-term outcomes. Media coverage amplified certain images and ignored others. Sensational stories of crime and violence drew attention. Quiet stories of recovery did not. Language choices mattered. Terms that conflated people with their condition hardened attitudes and made reform harder. Communities that changed their media narratives, emphasizing person-first language and reporting on evidence-based programs, made it easier for elected officials to shift policy without fearing backlash. Public opinion, when informed, supported pragmatic steps that reduced deaths and saved money. Racial inequities formed a persistent thread. Neighborhoods with fewer resources experienced higher surveillance and more arrests for conduct that occurred across all demographics. Sentencing differences accumulated into life course differences. Employment blocked by criminal records, voting rights curtailed, housing applications denied. Children grew up with parents under supervision or absent, and schools absorbed the consequences. The war on drugs in practice amplified existing inequalities. Reform that failed to address this would reproduce it by other means. The opioid crisis exposed contradictions. Prescription painkillers spread dependency across demographics that had once been treated as immune from the worst enforcement consequences. Many communities responded with calls for treatment-first approaches, highlighting the inconsistency with prior decades in which other communities had faced jail-first policies. This moment forced a reconsideration. If treatment was the correct tool for one population, why had punishment been the default for another? Some jurisdictions adjusted, but institutional habits changed slowly. The lesson was clear. Policy driven by compassion only when the affected population is politically powerful does not qualify as public health. Consistency is the mark of seriousness. A practical path forward relies on evidence, not ideology. Possession for personal use can be treated as a civil matter tied to voluntary referral pathways rather than as a criminal offense. Police can be trained and resourced to serve as connectors to services, carrying naloxone and referral cards and partnering with clinicians. First responders can deploy to overdose scenes with standing authority to provide on-the-spot linkage to medication programs. Hospitals can initiate medication empirically in the emergency department and hand off to outpatient providers within 48 hours. Pharmacies can dispense medications without stigma or arbitrary delay. Correctional systems can provide continuous access to medications and create release protocols that schedule intake appointments before discharge, including transport. These steps reduce mortality immediately and lower crime by stabilizing people who otherwise cycle through crisis. Harm reduction should be integrated, not treated as an extracurricular add-on. Needle and syringe services limit infections and create a point of contact for counseling, testing, and referrals. Drug checking services provide information about local supply, reducing poisonings by revealing adulterants and potency. Supervised consumption prevents death and public disorder while demonstrating to participants that contact with health workers does not require self-incrimination. Each intervention works better as part of a system that respects privacy and meets people without conditions that few can meet during initial contact. Education policy can correct earlier mistakes by teaching accurate, practical information. Adolescents need credible explanations of risk, instruction on recognizing overdose, guidance on seeking help without punishment, and skills for emotion regulation and peer support. Curricula that frame substances as omnipresent temptations defeated solely by willpower miss the basic realities of stress, trauma, and development. Curricula that combine neuroscience with social context, refusal skills with compassion for peers, and clear information about emergency responses equip students for real circumstances rather than imaginary ones. Measurement and transparency can keep programs honest. Public dashboards that track overdose deaths, infections, treatment capacity, wait times, medication access within correctional facilities, and housing stability turn abstractions into governance. Funding can be tied to outcomes rather than to ideological checklists. When a program reduces deaths, funds should grow. When a program fails to meet basic benchmarks, funds should move. This replacement of theater with accountability builds trust and channels limited resources toward interventions that work. Families require support equal to the demands placed upon them. Relatives often serve as first responders and long-term caregivers without training or respite. Programs that provide counseling, legal assistance, childcare support, and navigation services reduce burnout and improve outcomes. Workplace policies that allow flexible leave for caregiving acknowledge the social reality of addiction rather than pretending it is a private failing contained within four walls. Insurance rules that cover family therapy recognize that recovery occurs within systems, not only within individuals. Housing remains central. Stable housing reduces stress, improves treatment retention, and lowers criminal justice involvement. Models that prioritize housing first, offering shelter without preconditions, have demonstrated effectiveness for populations with co-occurring disorders. Transitional housing tied to employment and education supports provide structure without replicating institutional rigidity. Eviction policies that punish relapse push people into environments where risk increases. Policies that pair accountability with re-engagement save lives. Economic policy intersects with drug policy. Regions that lost industries and failed to replace them with living wage work experienced higher vulnerability to drug markets and to the despair that fuels demand. Programs that retrain workers, attract employers, and invest in transportation and childcare broaden the set of reasonable alternatives to illicit income and substance dependence. Economic development is not a substitute for treatment, but treatment without economic opportunity slows at the threshold of the clinic. Law enforcement can focus on violence, corruption, and trafficking rather than on possession. This requires training, metrics, and incentives that reward reduction of serious crime and collaboration with health systems. It also requires ending practices that underwrite budgets with forfeiture proceeds tied to low-level arrests. Agencies that adopt problem-oriented policing and that participate in multidisciplinary teams report improved community relationships and better crime control outcomes. These changes do not erase the need for enforcement. They aim it more precisely. Interdiction and international cooperation should be judged by harm reduction metrics, not by quantities seized. Seizures that raise price and lower purity can reduce overdose risk. Seizures that prompt rapid substitution with more potent synthetics can increase it. Crop substitution programs that provide farmers with viable alternatives work better than eradication alone. Anti-corruption initiatives that protect local officials and journalists create conditions for lawful economies to grow. The measure of success is safer communities, not impressive press conferences. The war on drugs is best understood as a misalignment between goals and tools. The stated goals were safety, health, and order. The chosen tools prioritized spectacle and punishment over stabilization and care. The outcome was predictable. Expensive systems that managed symptoms while deepening causes. Where policy shifted to align tools with goals, expanding access to treatment, integrating harm reduction, narrowing enforcement to the genuinely violent, metrics improved. Where policy remained locked in ideological posture, metrics stagnated or worsened. A serious society does not accept preventable death as the price of moral clarity. It chooses strategies that keep people alive long enough to benefit from change. It funds the unglamorous infrastructure of clinics, housing, and data systems. It trains professionals to welcome ambivalence, to expect relapse, and to persist without dramatizing either setback or success. It treats families as partners, not as afterthoughts. It writes laws that echo the evidence rather than nostalgia. It counts what matters and moves resources accordingly. This approach is not leniency. It is rigor applied to reality. It addresses violence with law and illness with care. It insists on accountability from institutions as well as from individuals. It replaces metaphors of war with practices of maintenance. It reduces harm first, then builds capacity for long-term change. It learns from jurisdictions that have achieved fewer deaths and fewer infections and imports those lessons without fear. It acknowledges that supply will always seek demand and that demand will follow distress unless distress is treated with something stronger than punishment. The war on drugs promised victory without understanding the battlefield. A replacement strategy accepts complexity. It begins with the premise that a community survives not by purging imperfection but by managing it with competence and humanity. When competence and humanity guide policy, the targets stop being people and become the problems that were always there. Pain without treatment, isolation without remedy, markets without alternatives, and laws without proportion. Those problems can be reduced. The record of better outcomes in jurisdictions that tried shows what is possible when evidence, not fear, leads.